I was looking through the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. No, actually, this was in Saturday's paper, I believe, again. In the religion section, what do you call this? A movie review? Written by Judson Shaver, who's president of Marymount Manhattan College in New York. He's a scholar of Christianity and Judaism in antiquity. You wouldn't know it by reading his thoughts on the Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ. I'll share some of these thoughts with you here and react to a bit of this. We've heard it before, even before the movie is out, even before the vast majority of people have seen Gibson's movie. Critics are already either faulting Gibson for deviating from the gospel texts, recording the last 12 hours of Jesus' life before his death and resurrection, or they're faulting him for sticking to those texts. It seems as though the guy who makes a film trying to depict the Passion of the Christ can't win or lose. Well, he can't win in any event, whether he sticks to the gospels or he doesn't. Here's another example. In Shaver's piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Misinterpreting the Passion is the title of the thing. Mel Gibson's movie merely reinforces anti-Semitic interpretations of the Gospels. He is faulted for sticking to the Gospel text and sticking to the way the texts read. I'll share it with you in just a moment. The first part of Issues, Etc. today is open lines for your questions and your comments. A little later in this hour, Marianne Hackett joins us, president of Illinois Right to Life. We'll be talking about a battle in the Illinois legislature over the so-called morning after pill. It goes under two names, either Preven or Plan B. There is a bit of legislation there in the Illinois legislature that would make this so-called emergency contraception legal over-the-counter without a prescription. And Marianne Hackett will tell us why she thinks that's a bad idea a little later in this first hour of Issues, Etc. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Ron Rhodes joins us. He is president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. We'll be talking to him about the creation-evolution debate, trying to fill in the gaps that all of us have on this subject. First of all, we have to figure out whether or not the two teachings, creation and evolution, are in any way compatible with one another. If they're not, if a real debate does exist, what do you need to know in order to defend the biblical view of a six-day creation? I am surprised at how few Christians are willing to basically pony up to that whole issue, a six-day creation. Apparently, this has now become an issue of kind of an open question. Maybe I've been naive all these years. Little secret, many of the guests that we have here on Issues, Etc., while we may agree with them heartily on many other issues, would also be of the mindset that a literal six-day creation, as accounted in Genesis 1 and 2, is not necessarily the only or the best interpretation of those first two chapters of the Bible. Although we may heartily agree with them on many other issues. I don't know. We'll be talking about it with Dr. Ron Rhodes, president of Reasoning from the Scriptures, in the second hour of the program. Then, in the first part of the third hour, we'll talk with the former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese about the marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The president came out earlier today saying he thinks it's a good idea. He will support it. He even called upon the Congress to start the wheels rolling for a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would define marriage as a man and a woman, but he said, would leave to the states other arrangements for same-sex couples, namely civil unions. Ed Meese will join us in the third hour, and then in the latter part of that third hour, Randy Thomason will join us. Campaign for California Families is his organization. He's executive director. We'll talk about gay marriage in San Francisco. Of course, it's not only now in San Francisco. It's also a little town outside of Albuquerque, if I'm not mistaken, New Mexico. They're doing it there as well, and I imagine that little scenario will be replaying itself over and over again in various states over the weeks to come. It's open lines. Anything you want to talk about, I'll be reacting to Judson Shaver's piece on Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It seems as though everyone is an expert, and the people that you should be able to rely upon for being expert in the areas of, say, biblical studies are the biggest skeptics when it comes to whether or not the Bible actually records anything of a historical nature. When we talk about modern biblical scholarship, I am often called to the carpet by listeners who say, look, you use the word scholar, you use the word scholarship. This stuff isn't scholarship. This stuff that denies the historicity of the gospel accounts of other things in the Bible, that's not scholarship. Well, you know, in some sense it is. The people who are coming up with these opinions, and they're not new, they've been around for, well, the better part of 150 years in the mainstream of Christianity, the people coming up with these ideas that the Bible is not an historical document, but is in fact the fanciful creation of people who had an axe to grind, who had an agenda, who may have taken certain events and sayings from the life of an historical figure named Jesus, but then embellished upon it in order to make their point, whatever it may be. Those opinions are widely held. And sad to say, those opinions are held by people who have genuine scholarly credentials. They're not only smart people, they're people with all the right letters and numbers after their names. They're people who do know how to read the original languages of the Old and New Testaments. They do know ancient history. You see, it goes to show that just because you know how to do those things will not necessarily lead you to the proper conclusion about those documents, the New Testament documents. Well, here's what Judson Shaver has to say. And you may have read this for yourself. The headline, Misinterpreting the Passion, Mel Gibson's Movie Merely Reinforces Anti-Semitic Interpretations of the Gospel. Now, going into this, bear in mind, Shaver's point is not to say that the movie is anti-Semitic or to say that Christianity per se, well, no. Or to say that Jesus was anti-Semitic or that Christians ought to be anti-Semitic. He's trying to thread the needle here. He's trying to say that the traditional reading of the Gospels as history is anti-Semitic. If you're willing to read them as non-historical documents, you won't be an anti-Semite. But if you're like Mel Gibson and read them as actual historical accounts of what really took place, well, you're going to end up being anti-Semitic whether you want to or not. That's Shaver's point. Here's how he makes it. In The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson does a credible job of bringing the Passion story to the screen. But the Passion story is not history, writes Shaver. Nor is it benign with regard to the Jews. I don't believe for a moment that Gibson is anti-Semitic. Yet his film is unhistorical and replicates the gospel, shifting blame from Rome to the Jews. Now, this is a big point that Shaver wants to make here. Shaver wants to say that those who wrote the original gospels, number one, you got to understand, at least from his viewpoint, that they were all written very late. They weren't written by people who are actually around to see the events or witness the things, or perhaps even had any eyewitness connection to Jesus, according to Shaver's viewpoint, which is still, sad to say, the majority opinion of so-called Bible scholars in the world today. It's not the right opinion, it is the majority opinion. These people who wrote the Gospels, well, what they did was they just pieced together their own ideas about Jesus. And that they wrote them very late, probably closer to 200 than to the lifetime of Jesus during his earthly ministry. And, Shaver says, they were written in order to distance Christians from Judaism. Now, there's a problem with his thesis there. It's widely accepted as a thesis among liberal Bible scholars that the Gospels were written in some way as a polemic against Judaism, as a way of distancing Christians from their Jewish roots. There's a problem with that. The problem is, well, I'll get to that in a minute. Shaver continues, this blame shifting is part of the broad strand of Christian anti-Semitism that begins in the New Testament and runs through modern, well-intentioned Christian thought. Two millennia of sometimes violent contempt of the Jews force us to ask some critical questions. Is anti-Semitism intrinsic or essential to Christianity? Does it go back to Jesus? If it does, can one remain a Christian? If it doesn't, he writes, What shall we do with the anti-Semitic text of the New Testament, to say nothing of the Passion plays and films like Gibson that are based upon them? Now, he is assuming that the text of the New Testament is anti-Semitic. In fact, that is his whole presupposition. In an effort to distance themselves from their Jewish roots, the early Christians, somewhere around 200, were furiously writing these so-called gospel accounts in order to distance themselves from Jews, and therefore, they are by definition anti-Semitic documents. They painted the Jews in the worst possible light, and they laid the blame for Jesus' crucifixion on the Jews rather than on the Romans. Now, first of all, have you read the gospel accounts? We're coming up on the Lenten season. I'm just a simple pastor. Yeah, I know the biblical languages probably better than a fair number of my colleagues. I can open up a Greek New Testament and read it. I can do a pretty fair job also with the Hebrew Old Testament. That doesn't make me an expert. It just makes me a decent pastor. But let's get back to Shaver, and I'll finish that thought in a moment. While scholars find it difficult to establish exactly what Jesus said or did, there is no reason to believe that he rejected Judaism or the Jews. Every textual indication that he did is better explained in the historical context of the author's experience than in that of Jesus. Now, this is a very clever way of saying, no, Jesus, the man, whoever he was, and we don't know who he was because the Gospels give us no reliable account of who he was, but Jesus, the man, whoever he was, certainly was not anti-Semitic. However, the texts recorded about him are bogus. They are anti-Semitic. But if you read them rightly, you can kind of redeem them. Now, notice what he's saying. He's saying they were written for anti-Semitic reasons, but we can take them today and reread them in a different light so that they don't draw us into anti-Semitic conclusions. This is classic liberal. This is a classic liberal method of reading the Bible. First of all the blame for whatever has happened in the history of the Christian church is laid at the doorstep of the Bible, because it's a bigoted book. It's an historically bogus book. It was written by people with an axe to grind. Therefore, we don't want to be infected by their bigotry, by their anti-Semitism. We do not want to be party to their axe grinding. So what we do is we take these texts that, as Shaver would say, are intrinsically anti-Semitic, and we reread them in a different way. But in order to do that, we have to disregard what the texts actually say. This is key. In order to read the Bible correctly, according to modern Bible scholarship, you have to disregard what it says. Do we do this with any other historical documents? Are we urged by scholars in any other field to do this with any other documents of antiquity? If someone were to, say, take Homer's Iliad, for which there is so little documentary evidence that we can barely put together a decent manuscript, and yet we have it, and people do not dispute where it came from or what it was supposed to be. If we were to take Homer's Iliad and say, look, it's so full of invective against various other peoples, it's so full of mythology, in order to rightly understand it, we really have to disregard what it says. No. There are people who get legitimate degrees of higher learning studying Homer's Iliad who are never asked once to disregard what the text says. And yet, in order to get a degree at the most prestigious institutions of higher learning today in biblical scholarship, you are virtually required to disregard what the documents you are supposedly studying have to say. If Jesus laments the wickedness of this generation, of his people, the Jews, well, we've got to reread that. And rereading means disregarding the text. Shaver goes on. The roots of Christian anti-Semitism do not go back to Jesus, nor is anti-Semitism intrinsic to Christianity. Now he's trying to redeem the whole lot here. He's made a feeble attempt to try and redeem Jesus from anti-Semitism, the text of the Gospels from anti-Semitism. Now he wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to blame Christianity for being anti-Semitic because it read these documents as history. But he also wants to say, but you know, Christianity isn't intrinsically anti-Semitic. It too can be redeemed if it's properly understood. Shaver goes on, if we can't abandon the New Testament, or even its truly regrettable passages, I believe that we can learn to read Scripture differently. In the past, we have read the New Testament text about the Jews as though they were really about the Jews. We learned that Pharisees were evil hypocrites, the Jewish leadership despicable, and the Jews collectively guilty of deicide, but none of this is true. I would ask Shaver, who is supposedly, I mean, it says he's a scholar of Christianity and Judaism in antiquity, at least that's what it says in the byline, I would ask him, show me the texts that collectively blame the Jews for deicide. Show them to me. I'm fairly familiar with the New Testament. I can think of no passages that collectively blame the Jews for deicide, or that let the Romans off the hook, or that let me or you off the hook, for that matter. But this is what passes for scholarship today. This is what passes for expertise in Christianity in antiquity. He concludes the Gospels actually reflect early Jewish Christians and their struggles to survive Rome and differentiate themselves from other forms of Judaism. Now, I got to take this up. I mentioned this before. Here is the weakness in his thesis. You are an early Christian. You come from a Jewish family. In Rome, Christians are being persecuted precisely because they are considered to be a deviant sect of Judaism. Jews, for the most part, are not being persecuted. They were at times, yes. Claudius expelled all the Jews from Rome at one point, but why did he do it? According to the secondary historical sources that we have on that, he expelled all the Jews from the city of Rome because of one Crestus, which historians take to be the name of Christ. The reason Claudius expelled all the Jews was because there were Christians among the Jews. Now, Shaver would have it that the Jews were being persecuted and being looked down upon by the Romans, and Christians, to kind of survive that, said, no, we're not Jewish. Don't associate us with the Jews. So they wrote these Gospels, these bogus mythical tales about Jesus, as a way of explaining to their Roman friends and neighbors, look, we're not Jewish. In fact, we blame the Jews just like you do for every ill in the world, including for killing our Savior. This is what he has to come up with as a scenario in order to support his reading of the Bible. But think about it. You're an early Christian. You have Jewish roots. Perhaps you were raised as a Jew, converted to Christianity. You're being persecuted because you're a Christian. Is it in your interest to say, no, I'm not a Jew? Or is it in your interest, if you're really just thinking about surviving persecution, to blend into the Jewish background? I mean, if they were as self-seeking and as simply interested in their own survival as Shaver would have us believe, wouldn't have been in the best interest of the early Christians to avoid persecution by blending into the Jewish background rather than standing out from it? He goes on, Christians forgot that the Gospels, with their passion narratives, were originally the literary and theological creation of Jews. As a result, many interpreters took the Gospels and mistook the story for history and took its negative portrayal of the Jews as fact. Again, I would say, where's the negative portrayal of the Jews in the Gospels? Where is it? There are certainly negative portrayals of Jews, but not of the Jews collectively as an ethnic group. In fact, you almost have to read it through anti-Semitic lenses to get that out of there. Don't you? That every reference to the so-called the Jews must somehow refer to the whole ethnic group of Jews worldwide? I mean, you really have to be looking for it in order to find that. Shaver says many of us know better, but millions of Christians don't, including, I fear, Mel Gibson and the large evangelical audience his film will attract. So now he has accused Mel Gibson again, While he started out by saying Mel Gibson isn't anti-Semitic and Christianity isn't anti-Semitic, he is concluding by saying Mel Gibson is anti-Semitic because he insists on reading these bogus documents, the Gospels, as though they were not but stories, but history. If Christians can learn to read the Gospels for what they are, says Shaver, we will discover an early Christian slander rather than Jewish guilt. So that's what the Gospels have been reduced to, in Shaver's opinion. Early Christian slander. By his reasoning, any film, anything that depicts the Gospel stories, in particular the Passion of Christ, as actual historical events, is of necessity anti-Semitic. That is his reasoning. If your pastor stands in the pulpit on Sunday morning and preaches to you as though what the Gospels record of Jesus suffering, his death, and his resurrection is actual history, your pastor is preaching anti-Semitism to you. That's Shaver's conclusion. If you go to Gibson's movie and you take it to be actual events that actually occurred, you are engaging in anti-Semitism. You were buying into Gibson's anti-Semitism, Christianity's anti-Semitism. If you take your children to Sunday school on Sunday morning and they are given a lesson in the trials of Jesus before the Sanhedrin and then before Pilate and then before Herod and then back to Pilate and then his execution, and your child comes away from Sunday school that morning saying, I learned about how Jesus suffered and died on the cross, and I believe it actually happened, your child is an anti-Semite because he took the Gospels to be literally true. And if you do that, according to Shaver, you will be an anti-Semite because they're anti-Semitic documents. They are, he says, an early Christian slander of Jews. Or let me put it in these simple terms. Oh, and don't you know there's a reason why Paul calls the gospel of Jesus Christ a stumbling block, a scandalon to Jews, and foolishness to Greeks? Shaver is essentially saying that if you believe the gospel, the message that God sent his Son into the world, and that at the hands of the chief priests, the Jewish leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees, and of course also the Romans as well, at those hands he was crucified and killed. If you believe that gospel, you are an anti-Semite. The gospel makes you anti-Semitic. Now the reason I read this for you folks, just be ready and beware, because this, I think, will probably be the lasting legacy by way of review of Gibson's Passion. This, I think, will probably be the label that will be stuck upon each of us who walk out of that movie theater saying, you know, I really believe it happened that way. I don't blame the Jews. I don't blame the Romans. I blame myself. That won't matter. You see, you believe it's true. Therefore, you must be anti-Semitic. When we come back from this break, 10 more minutes of open lines. Your questions and comments are invited. Stay with us.
Contending for Truth. In an age of anti-truth, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled, A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Russians who are searching. This young man, Jeremy Searsing, is from a missionary family, and his parents are working with universities and Russian artists.
There's one artist in particular who my mom's spent a lot of time with, working with, and you know, just in his home with their family. And a lot of his work has a lot of religious influence, but it's kind of dark and shadowy, and you know, you can tell that there's a lot of searching going on with that.
Searsing says there's great spiritual hunger in Russia, but most people who belong to the Russian Orthodox Church don't attend services on a regular basis. Only a few percent do. Pray for Christians in Russia to clearly proclaim Christ's love and also show love to each other. Pray for religious freedom to continue as well. Get updates on countries around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Years ago, I used to visit a retired farmer, Mr. John Melman. He once told me a story about the Depression. His hen hadn't laid any eggs, so he walked to the next farm and asked to borrow an egg, one egg. When Mr. Melman's hen did lay some eggs, he returned to his neighbor and paid his debt, one egg. Today is Shrove Tuesday, the day before Lent begins, a day for the last fling, the final selfish indulgences before the penitential season of self-denial begins on Ash Wednesday. Hence, the popular name for today is Fat Tuesday. Things have gotten very fat since the Depression. So fat that the idea of borrowing and repaying one egg is incomprehensible to most of us. Medical experts tell us that we Americans are obese, a condition that makes it harder for us to move around. I wonder, do we have it in us to move from our ever-self-indulgent culture to the penitence and self-denial of Ash Wednesday? Wrote Rabbi Abraham Heschel, "As long as man sees religion as a source of satisfaction for his own needs, it is not God whom he serves, but his own self." I'm Dale Meyer.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back. 10 minutes left in open lines. Then Marianne Hackett of Illinois Right to Life joins us to talk about the battle in the Illinois legislature over the morning after pill. Let's go to the phones at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Dale is calling from Ellisville. Dale, welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you, Pastor Wilkins. I agree completely with what you've been saying about the comments from this individual who obviously doesn't believe the scriptures. But there are a couple of references where Peter is preaching to the Jews up on the time of the Pentecost, and I see these as dealing with those people who were there at the time, not as a blanket indictment of any ethnic group of people. But I wondered how you, if you might address them just briefly, Acts 2:23. And then there's the other one in Acts 3, where it talks about you handed him over to be killed, and you disowned him. You disowned the holy and righteous one. It's in Acts 3 about 13, 14, 15. You killed the author of life. In verse 15, it says, but God raised him to the dead. I'd just like to hear your comments on that as regards... I believe he's actually dealing with a group of people who are current with the situation and who might have even been involved in some of the things that went on, but he definitely wasn't blanketly indicting a whole group of people.
And so, actually, I would even add to that, Dale, if you go forward in Acts chapter 7, let's see, you get Stephen doing essentially the same thing where it appears in his long speech in Acts chapter 7 that he is blaming the Jews per se for the death of Jesus. Verse 51 of Acts chapter 7, "You stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in hearts and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did. Which of the prophets did you not persecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered, you who received the law as delivered by angels and did not keep it."
Yeah, and I'm looking in a reference section here of the scriptures that goes way back to in Exodus, because God states some of these very same words way back in Exodus.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much. You've brought several important passages, and that's why I asked the question. Show me a passage where the Jews are explicitly blamed for killing Jesus. Now, I was asking with reference to the Gospels. You really must infer it from the Gospels. I mean, you have to infer it from the Gospels, because nowhere does it say in the Gospel readings, the Jews were responsible for all of this. Now, Jesus' own passion prediction says, "I'll be handed over to the chief priests. The chief priests, the leaders of the people, the elders, the scribes are going to take me, and they're going to hand me over to the Gentiles, and I'll be killed, and on the third day I will rise." Are they complicitous? Is there a group of Jews in Jerusalem who are complicitous in the actual events of Jesus' betrayal, arrest, trial, and crucifixion? Without a doubt. Without a doubt. But what is Peter saying in his... And no one disputes this. Not even the modern Bible scholars dispute this. They just say they shouldn't, for that reason, blame the whole nation. Well, in the Gospels, the whole nation isn't blamed. What is Peter saying when he says, "Men of Israel, this Christ whom you crucified"? Interesting enough, who is he preaching to? He's preaching to people who weren't even there. He's preaching to people from all over the known world at the time who have come in from Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, parts of Libya, Cyrene, Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians. People of every nation. Both Jews and proselytes. Now, they're there for the feast because they are devout followers of the Old Testament faith. But these are not all ethnic Jews. Not by a long shot. You even got a couple Cretans and Arabians tossed in there who are by no means Jewish. Paul is indicting his entire audience, including, and this is what Bible scholars will never do, including us. They refuse to believe that the words that Peter speaks there, I'm sorry, Peter speaks at Pentecost, speak to us too. On the one hand, they want to tell you, oh, these Gospels and the book of Acts and all that stuff, they're just made up history. They're not real history. And then on the other hand, they want to say, but we want to blame them, these documents, for being anti-Semitic. Well, if they're not real history, if they're just made up, why do you even pay attention to them? Who is Peter indicting? Us all. Who is Stephen indicting? In the words that I read there from Acts chapter 7. Is he saying to these leaders of Jerusalem who are actively getting ready to stone him to death, you are the actual guys who were there carrying out this plot? Yes. But does he thereby leave us out of the picture? By no means. By no means. You see, it's the refusal to see the preaching of repentance to you and to me that leads so-called Bible scholars of today to conclude that these must be anti-Semitic documents. I mean, he can't be preaching repentance to everybody. They refuse to let the scriptures speak to them as well as to the people it was addressed to originally. Tim is calling from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Yes, in fact, I think the previous caller may have swerved into or beat me to the punch, but... you know, his definition of anti-Semitism is stretched so wide that it would have to include the Old Testament.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would. You're right. The Old Testament, if read through the lens of modern Bible scholarship, is one of the most anti-Semitic documents ever produced. It paints the Old Testament people of God in a very unfavorable light. Anything else, Tim?
No, that was just, well... You know, in this whole realm of responsibility, I think it's kind of interesting you mentioned earlier, you know, Jesus himself predicted the whole thing. It was foreordained that it was going to happen, and yet the people who carried it out were responsible for it. And there's no effort in the New Testament to sort through that apparent contradiction.
Thank you very much, Tim. It is merely an apparent contradiction. Can the people of Jesus' day, the actual people who carried out the plot, be culpable, if only in a human sense, for their actions, and yet still be acting according to God's foreordained plan? Of course they can. Of course they can. Jesus says this later in the Gospel of John. No one takes my life from me. Now read, go see the movie on Wednesday. There is the biggest mystery to ponder when you watch this film where Jesus appears to be having his life wrenched from him inch by inch, blow by blow, nail by nail. For all the world, it looks as though his life is being taken from him, yet Jesus says in advance of this very thing, not only is it his hour of glory, now the hour has come. The Son of Man will be glorified. When I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself. But he says, no one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. This is my doing, not their doing. Who gets the blame at the cross? Jews? No. Me? No. You? No. Who gets the blame at the cross? What's the whole point of Jesus hanging dead on a cross? Who's getting the blame? All of the blame for everything, not just the plot to kill an innocent man, but every sin that's ever been committed. Who is being blamed when Jesus is being crucified, punished, and dying on the cross? Jesus is. This is the point that modern Bible scholarship misses entirely. It's the gospel. Who is to blame? God says when he crucifies his son, Jesus is to blame. Did he bear any responsibility for the sins that we have committed? No, he was without sin, yet God laid the sin of us all upon him. That's why Gibson geniusly begins the film with a quotation from the Old Testament in Isaiah that says, it was God's will that this happen. He was bruised for our iniquities. Who is being blamed on that day when Jesus is dying? Jesus is being blamed by God for us. We deserved the blame. Jesus got the blame. Jesus took the blame. He took the punishment. He took the death. And he did it gladly and of his own accord. No one took his life from him. Jesus says, I lay it down so that I may take it up again, which is precisely what he did. David's calling from Maryland Heights. David, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I read the the article, and I even emailed a letter to the Post, which I doubt very much they'll publish. But I think people have to be aware that the secular media, you know, gives platforms to these, you know, self-described scholars just to stir up the pot. And you know, what we need to do is promote or just tell the truth regarding dispensationalism, that there are more Christian Zionists that support Israel than there are Jews, and more of the money supporting the nation of Israel comes from you know, evangelical Christians than from the Jewish people. We're if you're a Christian and you really understand the Bible, you will love the Jewish people. You'll revere, you know, Jesus, even, you know, he was a Jew. All the apostles were Jews. And this is what I think the media needs to hear, because I think an awful lot of them really believe that Christianity is inherently bigoted towards Judaism.
David, thank you for the call. You know, that whole thing, well, Jesus was a Jew. All the apostles were Jews. It's true. It's true. But it always rings hollow to me. And I've always wondered, why does that never just sound right to me? Well, how could you say I'm anti-Semitic? Jesus was a Jew. How could anyone, every Christian, ever be anti-Semitic? Because Jesus was a Jew. Yes, he came through the line, the promised line of Abraham. No doubt about that. But Jesus didn't come into this world as a representative of the Jews. He came as the representative of all mankind. He's a new Adam. Every bit as much as he is ethnically a Jew. And make no mistake about it, Jesus was no practitioner of Judaism. He was a practitioner of the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, he's more than a practitioner of it. He's the object of that faith. Even if Jesus weren't a Jew, there would still be no call for anti-Semitism. Even if Jesus were a Cretan, there would be no call for anti-Semitism. Herman's calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. Excellent discussion you set forth on that matter. A lot of this, I think, and that type of assertion of this professor comes out of the background of World War II and Adolf Hitler's anti-Jewish and Holocaust policies that were particularly, among other groups, particularly singled out the Jewish people in Europe. And he even tried to manipulate the historical image of Martin Luther with a propaganda recounting that statement of Luther against the Jews, and to use it in Hitler's context to get sympathy for his political movement, whereas he intended to eradicate Christianity. He considered it a decadent Jewish religion. It's sort of curious that he didn't believe in Christianity or the God of Christianity, and if you follow that professor wrote that article to his conclusion, you come to the posture of German atheist Dr. Gerd Ludermann at the University of Göttingen. He's an out-and-out atheist. He doesn't believe in God, and that's where you go with this. So you come to the same place. And it's somewhat ironic that over the years, Felix Mendelssohn, who was a Jewish man and musician, arrangement for Hark the Herald Angels Sing and your own Pastor Balfour that you've had on the program, Jewish people have still come to Christianity and believed in it in spite of all this other hubbub of the history of the pogroms, of the Tsar and ghettos and so forth. They've seen the real issue in Christianity, that Jesus Christ is the true Messiah, the Son of God.
Herman, thank you so much. Couldn't have put it better myself. We need to get Eddie Balfour on about that. I mean, we need, after he's had an opportunity to see the film, Ed Balfour, of course, is the he's a Lutheran pastor who was raised in an Orthodox Jewish family, a convert to Christianity. And I'd like his take on this. He's probably as sensitive as anybody else on that whole subject. Final thought here before we conclude this conversation and go on to talk with Marianne Hackett about the morning after pill. Folks, do not be surprised, please. Do not be surprised if you are believed to be, if you're called anti-Semitic. Not because of any negative ideas or actions that you have or have taken toward Jews. Do not be surprised if you're called anti-Semitic simply for believing that what the Gospels recount of our Savior's life and death and resurrection is true. And if you're called an anti-Semite for believing that to be true, count it all joy. You'll be called worse than just an anti-Semite as time goes by. In Illinois, in the legislature, they're having a battle over the morning after pill, sometimes sold under the name of Previn or Plan B. Emergency contraception is what it is. Marianne Hackett is our guest. She's president of Illinois Right to Life. She joins us for the remainder of this hour to give us an update on what's going on in Illinois. Marianne, welcome back.
Hi, how are you, Pastor?
I'm doing well, Marianne. Tell us what's going on. What is being proposed in the Illinois legislature?
Well, they're proposing to make the morning after pill available without prescription, over the counter. And I don't know if you recall, but when the morning after pill first came out on the market, people like Planned Parenthood people and NARAL all recommended that every woman should have this in her medicine cabinet just in case. And the idea is that you can't possibly wait because it has to be taken within 72 hours. And to me, this is all something of a smokescreen because They're saying it's a contraceptive when in fact it's an abortion. And they're saying it will prevent pregnancies when in fact it ends pregnancies. There are lots of complications, but in the long run what they really want is this to be available for teens.
All right. Where else in the nation could a woman go in and buy over-the-counter without a doctor's prescription or even a doctor's recommendation this so-called emergency contraception Plan B or Previn, the morning after pill?
Well, they can't, and they can't even buy regular contraceptive pills over-the-counter. They have to have a prescription to buy regular contraceptive pills, and this morning after pill, which they call emergency contraception, doubles up the contraceptive pills. They have to take double doses of it for 12 hours. They begin within 72 hours after intercourse, and they have to take two doses of it within 12 hours, which doubles up the contraceptive dose. And there are all sorts of complications that from just the regular contraceptive pills. Stroke, blood clots, liver disease, damage to the liver. You know, there's all sorts of problems. They don't know what the long-range consequences of this heavy dose of contraceptives are, and what it will be on teenage children. You know, in 2000, the Congress passed a non-binding resolution to prohibit the use of federal funds to market it, the morning after pill, or give it to school children. And it was already at that time in 180 schools, they estimated. So in France, they're giving it to school children for a test. Does anyone care about our children anymore, I wonder?
So you are without a doubt on this, that the goal here is to get this into the hands of teenage girls.
Absolutely. I think that's the, you know, adult women can manage to find their way to things like that. It's the teenagers that don't have the wherewithal. They don't want to go to their parents. They don't want to have to go to their doctor and get a prescription. They want to be able to just go in a drugstore and buy it. And then that's another way of deceiving the parents. The parents won't know. They won't know they're having intercourse. They won't know that they're using this abortifacient pill. The sad thing about it is they keep calling it a contraceptive, and they're using the sleight of hand. The obstetricians in 1965 redefined the beginning of life as implantation. So that's why they're saying it will prevent pregnancy, because they are saying pregnancy begins with implantation. Pregnancy begins with fertilization. And otherwise, what is implanted? Something happened before that. But that's the sleight of hand they're using to describe this as a contraceptive.
Now, the sponsor of the bill in the Illinois legislature, Representative Sarah Feigenholz,
yes,
is quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as saying, "This is a bill for women who are in need of emergency contraceptives to prevent a pregnancy when a doctor's office or a clinic are not open."
Right.
Now, she's arguing basically for, I don't know, maybe the weekend fling where a woman needs to somehow prevent a pregnancy,
yes,
at least ostensibly.
Yes, when are a doctor's office or a clinic never open? Well, have they never heard of emergency rooms? I mean, it's incredible, the arguments they're using for it. And, of course, what they're saying is prevent pregnancy. It would have to be taken before ovulation. A pregnancy can happen within a few hours of intercourse. They're saying it's a contraceptive, but the woman could already be pregnant within the 72 hours that she's getting it. So then it acts to end the life of the child.
It seems to assume here, because again, Pam Sutherland, president of Illinois Planned Parenthood Council, says that this pill works exactly like the regular contraceptive pill. She says it works by stopping ovulation. The problem I see there is ovulation isn't taking place continuously in a woman. It takes place one time during the cycle every month. So in order for it to prevent ovulation, the woman would have to have had intercourse and then take the pill before ovulation occurs. She'd really have to time this out in order for it not to be an abortifacient.
They're misrepresenting the contraceptive pill as well. It acts in three ways. It prevents ovulation. It inhibits the movement of the sperm. But it also prevents implantation. An implantation means the new life is flushed out and is not allowed to implant in the womb, and that's an abortion. They're even misrepresenting what an actual contraceptive pill is, and then they're calling this a contraceptive pill.
Now, on Friday, the Food and Drug Administration agreed to delay a decision.
Yes, and that was curious, wasn't it? They were going to give the decision last week, and now they've delayed it for 90 days, which means to me that they've gotten a lot of feedback on it.
What do you think the FDA will eventually decide with regard to the so-called morning after pill?
Well, I'm hoping that the administration or the Health and Human Services will intervene in this. The very fact that they've postponed the decision for 90 days tells me that something is up. And I'm hoping that they ultimately determine that it will not be available over the counter, that people will understand that the target of this group.
And I just want you to, if you would, drive this point home again, Marianne, because I've got a daughter who's 12 years old.
Yes.
You know, they're talking about 16, 17-year-old girls, but if it is actually to be sold over the counter without a prescription, there's really nothing stopping a 13-year-old.
Absolutely not. There's no problem with a minor girl going in. There's no problem, you know, with a minor girl getting an abortion without parental notice or consent in Illinois. She could go into a drugstore and get that, and who can stop her if there's no parental requirement in the case? And to say in the beginning that every woman should have it in her medicine cabinet tells what I think what their motives are and what the goal is. And as I said, in France, they're giving it to teenage girls.
Marianne, with only 1 minute before we have to go and no more, where does the Illinois legislature stand? How do you count heads here? Where do you think this bill is going to go?
Well, this legislature is not the greatest, and it's hard to say. I think it's hard to get some of these bills through the Senate, and even though it's largely Democrat, there are pro-life Democrats in the state house. But they seem to not want to inhibit the advancement of Planned Parenthood or the abortion clack. And so it may very well pass, but whether it passes or not in Illinois, if the FDA prohibits the use of it without getting a prescription, then the federal law will supersede whatever they do in the state. It may be heads will be calm and tempers will be cool, and they'll wait and see what the FDA does about it before they pass any laws.
Marianne Hackett, thank you for being our guest. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Marianne Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. You can visit their website, illinoisrighttolife.org. It's all one word, illinoisrighttolife.org. Their telephone number, area code 312-422-9300. 312, area code 422-9300. When we come back from this break, the second hour of Issues Etc., Ron Rhodes joins us to talk about the creation-evolution debate. And in the third hour, former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese and Randy Thomason. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.